It drew slowly away and stopped, floating like a hovercraft. The third and fourth fingers folded slowly down against the palm.
"Don't kill him. Come out and stop me. If you make me try, you might get a surprise."
These voices were in his head. His hovercraft hand floated forward, and the first two fingers plunged into his nostrils, plugging them. For a moment, they were still. And then, oh dear Christ, they began to dig. And while Dick McCaskill had many questionable habits, chewing his nails was not one of them. At first, his fingers didn't want to move much up there, close quarters. But then, as the lubricating blood began to flow, they became positively frisky. They squirmed like worms. The dirty nails dug like fangs. They shoved up further, burrowing brainward. He could feel cartilage tearing, could hear it. "Stop it, Mr. Gray, stop it!" And suddenly, Deke's fingers belonged to him again. He pulled them free with a wet plop. Blood pattered down on the counter, on the rubber change pad with the Skoll logo on it, also on the unclad lass in glasses whose anatomy he had been studying when this creature had come in.
"How much do I owe you, Deke?"
"Take it."
Still that crow croak, but now it was a nasal croak because his nostrils were plugged with blood.
"Aw, man, just take it and go. The fuck out of here."
"No, I insist. This is commerce, in which items of real worth are exchanged for currency plain."
$3, Deke cried.
Shock was setting in. His heart was beating wildly, his muscles thrumming with adrenaline. He believed the creature might be going, and this made everything infinitely worse. To be so close to a continued life and still know it could be snatched away at this fucking loony's least whim. The loony brought out a battered old wallet, opened it, and rummaged for what seemed an age. Saliva drizzled steadily from his mouth as he bent over the wallet. At last, he came out with $3. He put them on the counter. The wallet went back into his pocket. He rummaged in his nasty-looking jeans, rode hard and put away wet, Deke thought, came out with a fistful of change, and laid 3 coins on the Skoll pad. 2 quarters and a dime.
"I tip 20%,
his customer said with unmistakable pride.
"Jonesy tips 15. This is better. This is more."
"Sure,"
Deke whispered. His nose was full of blood.
"Have a nice day. You take it easy."
The man in the orange coat stood with his head lowered. Deke could hear him sorting through possible responses. It made him feel like screaming. At last the man said,
"I will take it any way I can get it."
There was another pause. Then,
"I don't want you to call anyone, partner."
"I won't."
"Swear to God?"
"Yeah, swear to God."
"I'm like God," his customer remarked.
"Yeah, okay, whatever you...
If you call someone, I'll know. I'll come back and fix your wagon."
"I won't."
"Good idea." He opened the door. The bell jangled. He went out. For a moment, Deke stood where he was, as if frozen to the floor. Then he rushed around the counter, bumping his upper leg hard on the corner. By nightfall, there would be a huge black bruise there, but for the moment, he felt nothing. He turned the thumb lock, shot the bolt, then stood there peering out. Parked in front of the store was a little red shitbox Subaru, mud-splattered, also looking road-hard and put away wet. The man juggled his purchases into the crook of one arm, opened the door, and got in behind the wheel. "Drive away," Deke thought. "Please, mister, for the love of God, just drive away." But he didn't. He picked up something instead. The loaf of bread, and pulled the tie off the end. He took out roughly a dozen slices. Next, he opened the jar of mayonnaise, and, using his finger as a knife, began to slather the slices of bread with mayo. After finishing each slice, he licked his finger clean. Each time he did, His eyes slipped closed, his head tipped back, and an expression of ecstasy filled his features, radiating out from the mouth. When he had finished with the bread, he picked up one of the packages of meat and tore off the paper covering. He opened the plastic inner envelope with his teeth and shook out the pound of sliced bacon. He folded it and put it on a piece of bread, then put another piece on top. He tore into the sandwich as ravenously as a wolf. That expression of divine enjoyment never left his face. It was the look of a man enjoying the greatest gourmet meal of his life. His throat knotted as each huge bite went down. Three such bites, and the sandwich was gone. As the man in the car reached for two more pieces of bread, a thought filled Deke McCaskill's brain, flashing there like a neon sign. It's even better this way. Almost alive. Cold, but almost alive. Deke backed away from the door, moving slowly as if underwater. The grayness of the day seemed to invade the store, dimming the lights. He felt his legs come unhinged, and before the dirty board floor tilted up to meet him, gray had gone to black. When Deke came to, it was later. Just how much later he couldn't tell, because the Budweiser digital clock over the beer cooler was flashing 8888. Three of his teeth lay on the floor, knocked out when he fell down, he assumed. The blood around his nose and on his chin had dried to a spongy cake. He tried to get up, but his legs wouldn't support him. He crawled to the door instead, with his hair hanging in his face, praying. His prayer was answered. The little red shitbox car was gone. Where it had been were four bacon packages, all empty, the mayonnaise jar, three quarters empty, and half a loaf of wholesome white bread. Several crows, and there were some almighty big ones around the reservoir, had found the bread and were pecking slices out of the torn wrapper. At a distance, almost back to Route 32, two or three more were at work on a congealed mess of bacon and matted chunks of bread. Monsieur's gourmet lunch had not agreed with him, it seemed. God, Deke thought, I hope you puked so hard you tore your plumbing loose, you. But then his own guts took up a fantastical skipping leap, and he clapped his hand over his mouth. He had a hideously clear image of the man's teeth closing on the raw, fatty meat hanging out between the pieces of bread, gray flesh veined with brown like the severed tongue of a dead horse. Deke began to make muffled, yerking sounds behind his hand. A car turned in. Just what he needed, a customer, while he was on the verge of tossing his cookies. Not really a car at all on second glance, nor a truck either. Not even an SUV, it was one of those god-awful Humvees, painted in smeary camouflage blobs of black and green. Two people in front and, Deke was almost sure of it, another in back. He reached out, flipped the open sign hanging in the door over to closed, then backed away. He had gotten to his feet, had managed at least that much, but now he felt perilously close to collapsing again. They saw me in here just as sure as shit, he thought. They'll come in and ask where the other one went because they're after him. They want him. They want the bacon sandwich man. And I'll tell. They'll make me tell. And then I'll... His hand rose in front of his eyes. The first two fingers, coated with dried blood up to the second knuckles, were poked out and hooked. They were trembling. To Deke, they almost looked like they were waving. Hello, eyes. How you doing? Enjoy looking while you can, because we'll be coming for you soon. The person in the back of the Humvee leaned forward, seemed to say something to the driver, and the vehicle leaped backward, one rear wheel splashing through the puddle of vomit left by the store's last customer. It wheeled around on the road, paused for just a moment, then set off in the direction of Ware and the Quabbin. When they disappeared over the first hill, Deke McCaskill began to weep. As he walked back toward the counter, staggering and weaving but still on his feet, his gaze fell on the teeth lying on the floor. Three teeth. His. A small price to pay. Oh, yes,
teeny Jews.
Then he stopped, gazing at the $3 bills which still lay on the counter. They had grown a coating of pale red-orange fuzz.
Ah, dear, Ip Owen.
Owen? That's me, Owen thought wearily, but he understood Duddits well enough. It wasn't that hard once your ear had become attuned. Not here. Keep going. Owen reversed the Humvee to Route 32 as Duddits sat back, collapsed back, and began to cough again. Look, Henry said, and pointed. See that? Owen saw a bunch of wrappers soaking into the ground under the force of the pelting downpour, and a jar of mayonnaise. He threw the Hummer back into drive and headed north. The rain hitting the windshield had a particularly fat quality that he recognized. Soon it would turn back to sleet, and then, very likely, to snow. Close to exhausted now, and queerly sad in the wake of the telepathy's withdrawing wave, Owen found that his chief regret was having to die on such a dirty day. "How far ahead is he now?" Owen asked, not daring to ask the real question, the only one that mattered. Are we already too late? He assumed that Henry would tell him, were that the case.
"He's there," Henry said absently.
He had turned around in the seat and was wiping Duddits's face with a damp cloth. Duddits looked at him gratefully and tried to smile. His ashy cheeks were sweaty now, and the black patches under his eyes had spread, turning them into raccoon's eyes. "If he's there, why did we have to come here?" Owen asked. He had the Hummer up to 70, very dangerous on this slick stretch of two-lane blacktop, but now there was no choice.
"I didn't want to risk Duddits losing the line," Henry said. "If that happens..."
Duddits uttered a vast groan, wrapped his arms around his midsection, and doubled over them. Henry, still kneeling on the seat, stroked the slender column of his neck.
"Take it easy, Duds," Henry said. "You're all right."
But he wasn't. Owen knew it, and so did Henry. Feverish, crampy in spite of a second prednisone pill and two more Percocets, now spraying blood every time he coughed, Duddits Cavell was several country miles from all right. The consolation prize was that the Jonesy-Gray combination was also a very long way from all right. It was the bacon. All they'd hoped to do was to make Mr. Gray stop for a while. None of them had guessed how prodigious his gluttony would turn out to be. The effect on Jonesy's digestion had been fairly predictable. Mr. Gray had vomited once in the parking lot of that little store and had had to pull over twice more on the road to Ware, leaning out the window and offloading several pounds of raw bacon with almost convulsive force. Diarrhea came next. He had to stop at the Mobile on Route 9 southeast of Ware and had barely made it into the men's room. The sign outside the station read, "Cheap gas, clean toilets." But the clean toilets part was certainly out of date by the time Mr. Gray left. He didn't kill anyone at the Mobile, which Henry counted as a plus. Before turning onto the Quabbin Access Road, Mr. Gray had needed to stop twice more and dash into the sopping woods where he tried to evacuate Jonesy's groaning bowels. By then, the rain had changed over to huge flakes of wet snow. Jonesy's body had weakened considerably, and Henry was hoping for a faint. So far, it hadn't happened. Mr. Gray was furious with Jonesy, railing at him continuously by the time he slipped back behind the wheel of the car after his second trip into the woods. This was all Jonesy's fault. Jonesy had trapped him. He chose to ignore his own hunger and the compulsive greed with which he had eaten, pausing between bites only to lick the grease from his fingers. Henry had seen such selective arrangements of the facts, emphasizing some, ignoring others completely, many times before in his patience. In some ways, Mr. Gray was Barry Newman all over again.
"How human he's becoming," he thought. "How curiously human."
"When you say he's there," Owen asked, "just how there do you mean?"
"I don't know. He's closed down again, at least pretty much. Duddits, do you hear Jonesy?"
Duddits looked at Henry wearily, then shook his head.
"It's a hook our cards," he said.
Mr. Gray took our cards. but that was like a literal translation of a slang phrase. Duditz hadn't the vocabulary to express what had actually happened, but Henry could read it in his mind. Mr. Gray was unable to enter Jonesy's office stronghold and take the playing cards, but he had somehow turned them all blank.
"Duditz, how are you making out?" Owen said, looking into the rearview mirror.
"I-O-A,"
Duditz said, and immediately began to shiver. On his lap was his yellow lunchbox and the brown bag with his medicines in it, his medicines and that odd little string thing. Surrounding him was the voluminous blue duffel coat, yet inside it he still shivered. "He's going fast," Owen thought as Henry began to swab his old friend's face again. The Humvee skidded on a slick patch, danced on the edge of disaster. A crash at 70 miles per hour would probably kill them all, and even if it didn't, it would put paid to any final thin chance they might have of stopping Mr. Gray, and then came back under control again. Owen found his eyes drifting back to the paper bag, his mind going again to that string thing. "Beaver sent to me for my Christmas last week." Trying to communicate now by telepathy was, Owen thought, like putting a message into a bottle and then tossing the bottle into the ocean. But he did it anyway, sending out a thought in what he hoped was Duditz's direction. "What do you call it, son?" Suddenly and unexpectedly, he saw a large space, a combination living room, dining room, and kitchen. The mellow pine boards glowed with varnish. There was a Navajo rug on the floor, and a tapestry on one wall, tiny Indian hunters surrounding a gray figure, the archetypal alien of 1,000 supermarket tabloids. There was a fireplace, a stone chimney, an oak dining table. But what riveted Owen's attention, it had to, it was the center of the picture Duditz had sent him, and glowed with its own special light, was the string creation which hung from the center rafter. It was the Cadillac version of the one in Duditz's medicine bag, woven in bright colors instead of drab white string, but otherwise the same. Owen's eyes filled with tears. It was the most beautiful room in the world. He felt that way because Duditz felt that way, and Duditz felt that way because it was where his friends went, and he loved them.
"Dream catcher," said the dying man in the back seat,
and he pronounced the word perfectly. Owen nodded. "Dreamcatcher. Yes. It's you," he sent. Supposing that Henry was overhearing but not caring one way or the other, the message was for Duditz, strictly for Duditz. "You're the dreamcatcher, aren't you? Their dreamcatcher. You always were." In the mirror, Duditz smiled. They passed a sign which read, "Quabbin Reservoir, 8 miles. No fishing, no services. Picnic area open. Hiking trails open. Pass at own risk." There was more, but at 80 miles an hour, Henry had no time to read it.
"Any chance he'll park and walk in?" Owen asked.
"Don't even hope for it," Henry said. "He'll drive as far as he can. Maybe he'll get stuck. That's what you want to hope for. There's a good chance it might happen. And he's weak. He won't be able to move fast." "What about you, Henry? Will you be able to move fast?" Considering how stiff he was and how badly his legs ached, that was a fair question. "If there's a chance," he said, I'll go as hard as I can. In any case, there's Duditz. I don't think he's going to be capable of a very strenuous hike." "Any hike at all," he didn't add. "Kurtz and Freddy and Perlmutter. Henry, how far back are they?" Henry considered this. He could feel Perlmutter clearly enough, and he could touch the ravening cannibal inside him as well. It was like Mr. Gray, only the weasel was living in a world made of bacon. The bacon was Archibald Perlmutter, once a captain in the United States Army. Henry didn't like to go there. Too much pain. Too much hunger.
15 miles, he said. "Maybe only 12, but it doesn't matter, Owen. We're going to beat them. The only question is whether or not we're going to catch Mr. Gray. We'll need some luck or some help.
And if we catch him, Henry, are we still going to be heroes?" Henry gave him a tired smile.
"I guess we'll have to try."
Chapter 21.
Shaft 12. Mr. Gray drove the Subaru nearly 3 miles up East Street, muddy, rutted, and now covered with 3 inches of fresh snow, before crashing into a fault caused by a plugged culvert. The Subaru had fought its way gamely through several mires north of the Goodenough Dyke, and had bottomed out in one place hard enough to tear off the muffler and most of the exhaust pipe, but this latest break in the road was too much. The car went forward, nose first, into the crack, and lodged on the pipe, unmuffled engine blatting stridently. Jonesy's body was thrown forward and the seatbelt locked. His diaphragm clenched, and he vomited helplessly onto the dashboard. Nothing solid now, only bilious strings of saliva. For a moment, the color ran out of the world, and the rackety roar of the engine faded. He fought viciously for consciousness, afraid that if he passed out, even for a moment, Jonesy might somehow be able to take control again. The dog whined. Its eyes were still closed, but its rear legs twitched spasmodically, and its ears flicked. Its belly was distended, the skin rippling. Its moment was near. A little at a time, color and reality began to return. Mr. Gray took several deep breaths, coaxing this sick and unhappy body back to something resembling calm. How far was there still to go? He didn't think it could be far now, but if the little car was really stuck, he would have to walk, and the dog couldn't. The dog must remain asleep, and it was already perilously close to waking again. He caressed the sleep centers of its rudimentary brain. He wiped at his slimy mouth as he did it. Part of his mind was aware of Jonesy, still in there, blind to the outside world, but awaiting any chance to leap forward and sabotage his mission. And, incredibly, another part of his mind craved more food. Craved bacon, the very stuff which had poisoned it. "Sleep, little friend," speaking to the dog, speaking also to the Byram, and both listened. Lad ceased whining. His paws stopped twitching. The ripples running across the dog's belly slowed, stopped. This calm wouldn't last long, but for now, all was well as it could be. "Surrender, Dorothy." "Shut up," Mr. Gray said. "Kiss my bender." He put the Subaru in reverse and floored the accelerator. The motor howled, scaring birds up from the trees, but it was no good. The front wheels were caught firmly, and the back wheels were up, spinning in the air. "Fuck!" Mr. Gray cried and slammed Jonesy's fist down on the steering wheel. "Jesus Christ, bananas! Fuck me, Freddy!" He felt behind him for his pursuers and got nothing clear, only a sense of approach. Two groups of them, and the one that was closer had Duddits. Mr. Gray feared Duddits and sensed that he was the one most responsible for how absurdly, infuriatingly difficult this job had become. If he could stay ahead of Duddits, all would end well. It would help to know how close Duddits was, but they were blocking him. Duddits, Jonesy, and the one called Henry. The three of them together made a force Mr. Gray had never encountered before, and he was afraid. "But I'm still enough ahead," he told Jonesy, getting out. He slipped, uttered a beaver curse, then slammed the door shut. It was snowing again, great white flakes that filled the air like confetti and splashed against Jonesy's cheeks. Mr. Gray slogged around the back of the car, boots sliding and smooching in the mud. He paused for a moment to examine the corrugated silver back of the pipe rising from the bottom of the ditch which had trapped his car. He had also fallen victim in some degree to his host's mostly useless but infernally sticky curiosity. Then went on around to the passenger door. "I'm going to beat your asshole friends quite handily." No answer to this goad, but he sensed Jonesy, just as he sensed the others. Jonesy, silent, but still the bone in his throat. Never mind him. Fuck him. The dog was the problem. The Byram was poised to come out. How to transport the dog? Back into Jonesy's storage vault. For a moment, there was nothing, and then an image from Sunday school, where Jonesy had gone as a child to learn about God and God's only begotten Son, who appeared to be a Byrum, creator of a Byrus culture, which Jonesy's mind identified simultaneously as Christianity and bullshit. The image was very clear from a book called The Holy Bible. It showed God's only begotten Son carrying a lamb, wearing it almost. The lamb's front legs hung over one side of begotten Son's chest, its rear legs over the other. It would do. Mr. Gray pulled out the sleeping dog and draped it around his neck. It was heavy already. Jonesy's muscles were stupidly, infuriatingly weak, and it would be much worse by the time he got where he was going. But he would get there. He set off up East Street, through the thickening snow, wearing the sleeping border collie like a fur stole. The new snow was extremely slippery, and once they were on Route 32, Freddy was forced to drop his speed back to 40. Kurtz felt like howling with frustration. Worse, Perlmutter was slipping away from him into something like a semi-coma. And this at a time, goddamn him, when he had suddenly been able to read the one Owen and his new friends were after, the one they called Mr. Gray. "He's too busy to hide," Pearlie said. He spoke dreamily, like someone on the edge of sleep. "He's afraid. I don't know about Underhill, boss, but Jonesy, Henry, Duddits, he's afraid of them. And he's right to be afraid. They killed Richie."
"Who's Richie, Buck?"
Kurtz didn't give much of a squirt, but he wanted Perlmutter to stay awake. He sensed that they were coming to a place where he wouldn't need Perlmutter anymore, but for now, he still did.
"Don't know."
The last word became a snore. The Humvee skidded almost sideways. Freddy cursed, fought the wheel, and managed to regain control just before the Hummer hit the ditch. Kurtz took no notice. He leaned over the seat and slapped Perlmutter on the side of the face hard. As he did so, they passed the store with the sign reading, "Best Bait, Why Wait?" in the window.
"Ow!"
Pearlie's eyes fluttered open. The whites were now yellowish. Kurtz cared about this no more than he cared about Richie.
"Don't, boss!"
"Where are they now?"
"The water," Pearlie said. His voice was weak, that of a petulant invalid. The belly under his coat was a distended, occasionally twitching mountain.
"Ma Jode in her 9th month. God bless and keep us," Kurtz thought.
"The water."
His eyes closed again. Kurtz drew his hand back to slap. "Let him sleep," Freddy said. Kurtz looked at him, eyebrows raised.
"It's got to be the reservoir, he means. And if it is, we don't need him anymore."
He pointed through the windshield at the tracks of the few cars that had been out this afternoon ahead of them on Route 32. They were black and stark against the fall of fresh white snow. "There won't be anyone up there today but us, boss. Just us.
Praise God."
Kurtz sat back, picked his 9mm up off the seat, looked at it, and put it back in its holster.
"Tell me something, Freddy."
"I will if I can."
"When this is over, how does Mexico sound to you?"
"Good, as long as we don't drink the water." Kurtz burst out laughing and patted Freddy on the shoulder. Beside Freddy, Archie Perlmutter slipped deeper into coma. Inside his lower intestine, in that rich dump of discarded food and worn-out dead cells, something, for the first time, opened its black eyes. 2 stone posts marked the entrance to the vast acreage surrounding the Quabbin Reservoir. Beyond them, the road closed down to what was essentially a single lane, and Henry had a sense of having come full circle. It wasn't Massachusetts, but Maine, and although the sign said Quabbin Access, it was really the deep-cut road all over again. He actually found himself looking up at the leaden sky, half expecting to see the dancing lights. What he saw instead was a bald eagle, soaring almost close enough to touch. It landed on the lower branch of a pine tree and watched them go by. Duddits raised his head from where it had lain against the cool glass and said,
"It's a walk-in now."
Henry's heart leaped.
"Owen, did you hear?"
"I heard," Owen said, and pressed the Humvee a little harder. The wet snow beneath them was as treacherous as ice, and with the state roads behind them, there was now only a single set of tracks leading north toward the reservoir.
"We'll be leaving our own set," Henry thought. "If Kurtz gets this far, he won't need telepathy."
Duddits groaned, clutched his middle, and shivered all over.
"Annie, I sick. Duddits sick."
Henry brushed Duddits's hairless brow, not liking the heat of the skin. What came next? Seizures, probably. A big one might take Duds off in a hurry, given his weakened condition, and God knew that might be a mercy. The best thing. Still, it hurt to think of it. Henry Devlin, the potential suicide, and instead of him, the darkness had swallowed his friends, one by one.
"You hang in there, Duds. Almost done now."
But he had an idea the toughest part might still be ahead. Duddits's eyes opened again.
"It's a tuck."
"What?" Owen asked. "I didn't get that one."
"He says Mr. Gray got stuck," Henry said, still brushing Duddits's brow.
Wishing there was hair to brush, and remembering when there had been. Duddits's fine blonde hair. His crying had hurt them, had chopped into their heads like a dull blade, but how happy his laughter had made them. You heard Duddits Cavell laugh, and for a little while you believed the old lies again, that life was good, that the lives of boys and men, girls and women had some purpose, that there was light as well as darkness.
"Why doesn't he just throw the goddamn dog into the reservoir?" Owen asked, his voice cracked with weariness. "Why does he feel he has to go all the way to this shaft 12? Is it just because the Russian woman did?"
"I don't think the reservoir is sure enough for him," Henry said. "The standpipe would have been good, but the aqueduct is even better. It's an intestine 65 miles long, and shaft 12 is the throat. Duddits, can we catch him?" Duddits looked at him from his exhausted eyes, then shook his head. Owen pounded his own thigh in frustration. Duddits wet his lips, spoke two words in a hoarse, near whisper. Owen heard them, but couldn't make them out.
"What? What did he say?"
"Only Jonesy."
"What does that mean? Only Jonesy what?"
"Only Jonesy can stop him, I guess." The Hummer skidded again, and Henry grabbed hold of the seat. A cold hand closed over his. Duddits was looking at him with desperate intensity. He tried to speak and began coughing instead. Gruesome, wet, hacking sounds. Some of the blood that came out of his mouth was markedly lighter, frothy, and almost pink. Henry thought it was lung blood. And even while the coughs shook him, Duddits's grip on Henry's hand didn't loosen.
"Think it to me," Henry said. "Can you think it to me, Duds?"
For a moment there was nothing but Duddits's cold hand closed over his, Duddits's eyes locked on his. Then Duddits and the khaki interior of the Humvee, with its faded scent of surreptitiously smoked cigarettes, was gone. In its place, Henry sees a pay telephone, the old-fashioned kind, with different-sized holes on top, one for quarters, one for dimes, one for nickels. The rumble of men's voices and a clack-clacking sound hauntingly familiar. After a moment, he realizes it's the sound of checkers on a checkerboard. He's looking at the payphone in Goslin's, the one from which they called Duddits after the death of Richie Grenadeau. Jonesy made the actual call because he was the only one with a phone he could bill to. The others gathered around, all of them still with their jackets on because it was so cold in the store. Even living in the big woods with trees all around him, old man Goslin wouldn't throw an extra log in the stove. What a fucking pisser. There are two signs over the phone. One reads, "Please limit all calls to 5 mins." The other one... There was a crunching bang. Duddits was thrown against the back of Henry's seat, and Henry was thrown into the dashboard. Their hands parted. Owen had skidded off the road and into the ditch. Ahead of them, the Subaru's tracks, fading now under fresh cover, ran off into the thickening snow. "Henry, you all right?"
Yeah. Dud's okay?
Duditz nodded, but the cheek he had struck was turning black with amazing speed. Your leukemia at work for you. Owen dropped the Humvee's transmission into low range and began to creep up the ditch. The Humvee was canted at a severe angle, maybe 30 degrees, but it rolled pretty well once Owen got it moving.
Fasten your seatbelt. First fasten his, though.
He was trying to tell me... I don't give a damn what he was trying to tell you. This time, we were all right. Next time, we could roll 360. Fasten his belt, then your own.
Henry did as he was told, thinking about the other sign over the payphone. What had it said? Something about Jonesy. Only Jonesy could stop Mr. Gray now. That was the gospel according to Duditz. What had the other sign said? Owen was forced to drop his speed to 20. It made him crazy to creep like this, but the wet snow was falling furiously now, and visibility was back to nearly zero. Just before the Subaru's tracks disappeared entirely, they came to the car itself, nose down in a water-carved ditch running across the road, passenger door open, rear wheels in the air. Owen stepped on the emergency brake, drew his Glock, opened his door. "Stay here, Henry," he said, and got out. He ran to the Subaru, bent low. Henry unlatched his seatbelt and turned to Duditz, who was now sprawled against the back seat, gasping for breath, held in a sitting position only by the seatbelt. One cheek was a waxy yellow. The other had been engulfed by spreading blood under the skin. His nose was bleeding again, the wads of cotton sticking out of the nostrils, soaked and dripping.
"Duds, I'm so sorry," Henry said. "This is a fuckerow."
Duditz nodded, then raised his arms. He could only hold them up for a few seconds, but to Henry, his meaning seemed obvious enough. Henry opened his door and got out just as Owen came running back, his Glock now stuck in his belt. The air was so thick with snow, the individual flakes so huge that breathing had become difficult.
"I thought I told you to stay where you were," Owen said.
"I only want to get in the back with him."
"Why?"
Henry spoke calmly enough, although his voice trembled slightly.
"Because he's dying," he said. "He's dying. But I think he has one more thing to tell me first."
Owen looked in the rearview mirror, saw Henry with his arms around Duditz, saw they were both wearing their seatbelts, and fastened his own. "Hold him good," he said. "There's going to be a hell of a jounce." He reversed 100 feet, put the Hummer in low, and drove forward, aiming for the spot between the abandoned Subaru and the right-hand ditch. The crack in the road looked a little narrower on that side. There was indeed a hell of a jounce. Owen's seatbelt locked, and he saw Duditz's body leap in Henry's arms. Duditz's bald head bounced against Henry's chest. Then they were over the crack and once more rolling up East Street. Owen could just make out the last phantom shapes of shoe prints on the now white ribbon of the road. Mr. Gray was on foot, and they were still rolling. If they could catch up before the bastard cut into the woods. But they didn't. With a final, tremendous effort, Duditz raised his head. Now Henry saw with dismay and horror, Duditz's eyes were also filling with blood. Clack, clack, clack. The dry chuckles of old men as someone accomplishes the fabled triple jump. The phone began to swim into his field of vision again, and the signs over it.
"No, Duditz," Henry whispered. "Don't try. Save your strength."
But for what? For what, if not for this? The sign on the left, "Please limit all calls to 5 mins. Smells of tobacco, smells of wood smoke, the old brine of pickles, his friend's arms around him. And the sign on the right, "Call Jonesy now."
Duditz,
his voice floating in the darkness. Darkness, his old friend.
"Duditz, I don't know how."
Duditz's voice came to him a final time.
very tired, but calm, quick, Henry. I can only hold on a little longer. You need to talk to him. Henry picks the telephone's receiver out of its cradle, thinks absurdly, but isn't the whole situation absurd, that he doesn't have any change, not so much as a crying dime, holds the phone to his ear. Roberta Cavell's voice comes, impersonal and businesslike.
Massachusetts General Hospital, how may I direct your call?
Mr. Gray flailed Jonesy's body along the path which ran up the east side of the reservoir from the point where East Street ended, slipping, falling, grabbing branches, getting up again. Jonesy's knees were lacerated, the pants torn open and soaked with blood. His lungs were burning, his heart beating like a steam hammer. Yet the only thing that concerned him was Jonesy's hip, the one he'd broken in the accident. It was a hot and throbbing ball, shooting pain all the way down the thigh to the knee and up the middle of his back along the road of his spine. The weight of the dog made things worse. It was still asleep, but the thing inside was wide awake, held in place only by Mr. Gray's will. Once, as he was rising to his feet, the hip locked up entirely, and Mr. Gray had to beat it repeatedly with Jonesy's gloved fist to make it let go again. How much farther? How much farther through the cursed, stifling, blinding, never-ending snow? And what was Jonesy up to? Anything? Mr. Gray didn't dare let go of the Byram's restless hunger. It had nothing even approaching a mind, long enough to go to the door of the locked room and listen. A phantom shape appeared ahead in the snow. Mr. Gray paused, gasping and peering at it, and then fought his way forward again, holding the dog's limp paws and dragging Jonesy's right foot. Here was a sign nailed to the trunk of a tree. Absolutely no fishing from Shaft House. 50 feet beyond it, stone steps rose up from the path. 6 of them. No, 8. At the top was a stone building on a stone foundation that jutted out into the snowy gray nothing where the reservoir lay. Jonesy's ears could hear water lapping against stone, even over the rushing, labored beat of his heart. He had come to the place. Clutching the dog and using the last of Jonesy's depleted strength, Mr. Gray began to totter up the snow-covered steps. As they passed between the stone posts marking the entrance to the reservoir, Kurtz said, "Pull over, Freddy. Side of the road." Freddy did as he was asked without question.
"You got your auto, laddie?"
Freddy lifted it. The good old M16, tried and true. Kurtz nodded.
"Sidearm?"
.44 Magnum, boss. And Kurtz with the 9, which he liked for close work. He wanted this to be close work. He wanted to see the color of Owen Underhill's brains.
"Freddy?"
"Yes, boss. I just wanted you to know that this is my final mission, and I couldn't have hoped for a finer companion." He reached out and gave Freddy's shoulder a squeeze. Beside Freddy, Perlmutter snored with his Ma Joe'd face tipped up toward the roof. 5 minutes or so before reaching the stone pillars, he had passed several long, spectacularly odoriferous farts. After that, Pearlie's distended gut had gone down again. Probably for the last time, Kurtz thought. Freddy's eyes, meanwhile, had grown gratifyingly bright. Kurtz was delighted. He had not entirely lost his touch, even now, it seemed.
"All right, Buck," Kurtz said. "Full speed ahead and damn the torpedoes, right?"
"Right, sir."